We've been talking about men's responsibility in marriage, and we said that there are four responsibilities. We are looking at the first one. The first is to exercise loving servant leadership. Exercise loving servant leadership, not dictatorial dominion, as one writer called it. We are to exercise loving servant leadership, not dictatorial dominion. And there are four ways that we can describe this love, or that I should say Paul describes this love from Ephesians chapter 5. The first way is that this kind of loving servant leadership is sacrificial. It is sacrificial. We said last week, and that's where we left this last week, that a husband loves by dying to his own interests and looking out for the best interests of his mate. Now, I want to share an illustration with you. I ran across this illustration in a book by Tony Dungy entitled The Mentor Leader. Tony Dungy was an NFL coach. He's now a commentator on one of the networks that has NFL football. And he is a Christian and a committed Christian, has had quite a difference, made quite a difference in the people on his teams as well as the people throughout the NFL. And in his book, The Mentor Leader, which is about, I think he wrote about or was released about 3 years ago, he shared this illustration. Now, I don't know who this man is. I don't follow, you know, I watch games. I don't follow it as deeply as this. But he's talking about a man by the name of Mike Mularkey. And he said, Mike Mularkey played for the Pittsburgh Steelers and Minnesota Vikings before becoming an outstanding coach for a number of NFL teams. Several years ago, while he was still an assistant, he was offered an opportunity to become a head coach, which was his ultimate goal in coaching. When I heard about the offer sometime later and how he had quietly and without a lot of fanfare turned down the job, I asked him why he had declined. The story is one you don't see lived out much today. It goes against all that society preaches to us as the route to success. Mike's eldest son was about to enter his senior year of high school, and the Mularkeys decided they wanted him to be able to finish at the school where he had been for his first 3 years. Mike and his wife Betsy agreed that if Mike were to take the head coaching position, he would go alone and allow the family to stay in Pittsburgh until their son graduated. The offer was attractive, but the more Mike thought about it, the more uncomfortable he became with the idea of a 300-mile commute and the time away from his family that the distance would create. He knew that the long hours and the demands of an NFL training camp in season would limit his trips home. He had witnessed a similar scenario a few years earlier when the Steelers had hired an assistant coach from the Seahawks. This coach had left his family behind in Seattle, where they planned to stay for a year before joining him in Pittsburgh. However, almost immediately after he took the job with the Steelers, the coach's wife was diagnosed with an advanced stage of cancer. She needed to stay in Seattle for treatment, and he visited whenever he could, but not nearly as much as he wanted. She died within months of the diagnosis, and as a result, he missed both the quantity and quality of time he and she should have had in her last days. Sometimes tomorrow never comes. After weighing the cost, Mike declined the head coaching position. Other people have to commute all the time, he said, but we didn't have to. My family didn't need for me to be an NFL head coach. If I'd taken the job, it would have been about me. As the leader of his family, he realized that his decision needed to be about them, so he passed on the opportunity. You see, he put his wife and he put his family ahead of his own ambition, and that's what Paul is calling husbands to do in Ephesians chapter 5, to put our wives, to put our families ahead of ourselves, to be loving servant leaders, to be sacrificial leaders, not to exercise some kind of dominion over our spouse or our family, not to exercise some kind of dictatorship, but to exercise a loving servant leadership that's sacrificial and sacrifices many times our own interests for the interest of our wives, for the interest of our families. Dungy calls this service-directed leadership. Let me share with you something he said. The principal focus of servant-directed leadership must be on a point beyond ourselves. Such leadership must be other-directed and other-inspired. Mentor leadership must be grounded in and springing from an emphasis on service as its primary focus. By the way, folks, you see, this has application beyond marriage, doesn't it? Has application to all who are in leadership positions of one form or another. Dungy goes on to say, mentor leaders desire to help those they are privileged to lead to be better in whatever roles and responsibilities they have. Truly serving others requires putting ourselves and our desires aside while looking for ways and opportunities to do what is best for others. In marriage, that's looking for opportunities and ways to do what is best for our mate, what is best for our families. Dungy says, don't get me wrong, it's not easy. Not only that, but it runs contrary to the prevailing wisdom of the world, which focuses on personal success, achievement, and advancement. We live in a world that insists on looking out for number one. What God is saying through Paul in Ephesians chapter 5 is that husbands, you can't be looking out. We can't be looking out for number one. We can't be looking out for ourselves. We have to be looking out for our families. And many times, that means we have to be sacrificial in our decisions, sacrificial in the way we live, sacrificial in the things we do, sacrificial in the decisions we make, sacrificial in the priorities we have. That's true leadership. That's true male headship in a family. That's truly what God desired. I shared this quote with you last week from William Barclay, who said this, the husband is the head of the wife. True, Paul said that, but he also said that the husband must love the wife as Christ loved the church, with a love which never exercises a tyranny of control, but which is ready to make any sacrifice for her good. This loving servant leadership is to be sacrificial. Secondly, this loving servant leadership is to be caring. We get that from verses 26 and 27 in Ephesians 5. Look with me at verses 26 and 27. The topic is verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Verse 26 says, gives us the reason for that, to make her holy, cleansing her. He's talking here about Christ's relationship to the church, his bride, the church. He's using that as analogy for our relationship to our bride. Okay, and he says, Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her. It was a sacrificial love. Why did he do it? Verse 26 and 27, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Paul is saying that this kind of love that we are to have, this kind of leadership we are to exercise, is not only supposed to be sacrificial, but it is also supposed to be nurturing. Nurturing. That's what verses 26 and 27. It is a nurturing kind of love. That is, it's a love it's a leadership and a love where we know our wives and we look out for their best interest and we want them to come to a full potential. We live in such a way, we know our wives in such a way, we love our wives in such a way that they can reach their full potential. And that's the idea behind this nurturing kind of love. A husband is called to a nurturing love, a nurturing leadership which seeks the full development of his wife spiritually and emotionally. Now, by the way, you can't do that if you don't know her. You can't do that if you're not spending time together. You can't do that if you're not communicating with one another. You have to communicate. You have to spend time. You have to know her in order to be concerned about and help her to grow spiritually and emotionally. One writer said this, similarly, a husband sacrifices his own interests for his wife's sake, not if she will start to make some self-improvements, but so she may grow to maturity. It is a nurturing love that seeks to see our wives come to their full potential. In other words, we're their greatest cheerleader. We're their greatest cheerleader. We look at their lives and say, how can I help? How can I help in the areas that hurt her? How can I help in the areas that she'd like to grow? How can I help her in the areas that she'd like to move forward and advance in her life? How can I be a part of that? How can I promote that? How can I help that? That's the kind of leadership, that's the kind of headship that Paul is calling for in Ephesians chapter 5. Puts aside, it's sacrificial. We put aside our own desires for that of our family. It is a nurturing love. We seek to see our wives come to their full potential. And we become their greatest and their best cheerleader. The third part of this kind of love, this kind of loving servant leadership, is it is a caring love that meets our wives' material needs. It's a caring love that meets our wives' material needs. That's verses 28 to 30 in Ephesians 5. In the same way, Paul writes, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. Now, Paul is saying here that in the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own body. You see, self-love is assumed. Self-love is assumed in the Bible, that we would love our own body. Paul said the way you can tell that you love your body, men, is you feed it and you care for it, don't you? You sit down to 3 meals a day. And you care for your body. You take care of your body. That means you love your body. Well, where did your wife come from? You see how it all goes back to Genesis? Do you see how it all goes back to Genesis chapter 2, where God, at Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, where God created Adam and he took a part out of Adam's side. By the way, it was probably part of a rib, some muscle, some tissue, some blood out of his side. And out of that, he formed woman. He formed Eve. In a very real sense, they are one. They are one. And that oneness is reestablished every time a couple says, I do, and they take their marriage vows, that they become one in God's sight. So if a man is loving his wife, he is loving himself. In a good sense. He who loves his wife, Paul said, loves himself also. One writer put it this way, so intimate is the relationship between man and wife that they are fused into a single entity. For a man to love his wife is to love himself. She is not to be treated as a piece of property as was the custom in Paul's day. She is to be regarded as an extension of a man's own personality and so part of himself. Paul said, you know, men, you love your own body. You feed it, you take care of it. And you are one with your wife because God made you one with your wife. Therefore, to take care of her is to take care of yourself, so to speak. Because Christ loves his body, he feeds it and cares for it. Because a man loves his body, he feeds it and cares for it. And those words feed, that has the idea to nourish, to provide for. The word cares for has the idea of cherish, to protect, to care for, to warm, to take care of, to warm, exercise tender care. That's the idea behind nourishing and cherishing or feeding and caring for it. Christ loved the church, his body, so husbands should love their wives, their body. Now, what does this mean to nourish and to cherish? How can we see this in a tangible way? Well, one writer put it this way. The idea is protection, affection, and tangible and practical support. Protection, affection, and tangible and practical support. In other words, to feed and care for your body, you feed and care for your body, to do that for your wife means that you will protect her. It means that you will be affectionate toward her. And it means also in a very real way that there are tangible and practical ways that you support your wife and you support your family. Now, it's really interesting because in the book that I've mentioned to you many times, His Needs, Her Needs by Willard Harley, he mentions the five greatest needs of men and the five greatest needs of women. Well, guess what? One of the five needs, and just to remind you, that he came up with those over years of counseling. He said, as I sit down and I counsel couples about marriage and I listen to them, he said, basically I hear men talking about five primary needs, women talking about five primary needs, and the interesting thing is they're not the same. That's why you got to know your wife. And wife, you got to know your husband, okay? They're not the same. But one of those five primary needs that he hears all the time for a woman is that she needs enough money to live comfortably, in his words. She needs enough money to live comfortably. In other words, it is your duty, gentlemen, to make sure you're taking care of your wife and your family in a material way. Harley says this. Let me share with you some what he says. Humorous anecdotes abound on women who marry men for their money, but my counseling experience has taught me not to treat this tendency as a joke. In truth, a woman does marry a man for his money. At least she wants him to earn enough money to support her as well or better than her father did when she was growing up. Said in his counseling and his experience, he has seen that a woman wants her husband to care for her, take care of her, provide for her at least as well as her father did as she was growing up. He went on to say, whatever women say in public about their willingness to share the burden of making a living, in private I hear something entirely different. Married women tell me they resent working if their working is an absolute necessity. Do you hear that? Okay. He's not saying married women always resent working. There are many married women who want to work, enjoy working, and there's nothing wrong with that. As long as they're doing also what their husband's doing, and that is making sure the family's taken care of. There's nothing wrong with that. But what he's saying here is when a woman is forced to work to take care of the basic needs of the family, she resents that. Even part-time work sometimes, this I'm quoting again from the book, even part-time work sometimes irritates them if their income has to help pay for basic living expenses. A husband's failure to provide sufficient income for housing, clothing, food, transportation, and the other basics of life commonly cause marital strain in our society. The women I talk to usually like to have a choice between following a career and being a homemaker, or possibly they want some combination of the two. Ideally, they want to be homemakers in their younger years when their children are small. Later, when the children have grown, they often want to develop careers outside the home. He goes on to say, notice I said ideally. Hard reality for many women dictates that they must work to help make ends meet. Their husbands simply can't handle the basic monthly bills on one salary. He said, I strongly disagree with the materialistic trend that has forced women into the workforce simply to keep up with the Joneses, not to mention just to keep up with the bank and the credit card bills. Many couples set a standard, and here is his solution. Many couples set a standard of living for themselves far higher than they need to be happy. But this trend is not based on principles of economic or psychological necessity. Another obvious but ignored alternative to demanding that the husband earn more money to put his wife to work to bring in a second paycheck calls for the couple to cut their standard of living back to the point where the family can live comfortably on one salary. In other words, what he's saying and what I'm saying here is that you have to look at that and you have to talk with your wife and you have to decide what is the level that we should be living at? What is the proper level we should be living at before God? Because, and the only way to determine that, you don't determine that first by saying, what do my neighbors have? You know, my neighbors have a new car every year. I need to have a new car every year. No, you don't. My neighbor has this or that toy. I need to have this or that toy. No, you don't. You can live without it. You see, you have to start with your priorities. What are your priorities? My priority is my wife and my family. That's my priority. I need to take care of them first. How can I best do that? How can I best do that? I think that's part of what Paul's talking about here when he talks about this caring kind of love in verses 28 to 30 of Ephesians chapter 5. With this, not only protection, it's not only affection, but it's tangible and practical support. Tangible and practical support. Just a little more I'd like to share from Harley. He says, whenever I counsel families with financial problems, it usually takes about 6 months for them to determine their correct budget. They tend to start with a want budget more than a need budget. Soon, however, they discover the expenses that do not actually contribute to their sense of well-being. As they eliminate these unnecessary items, they learn that they have certain portions of their income more out of habit than out of necessity. They have spent certain portions of their income more out of habit than out of necessity. He says almost any family can live comfortably on less than they presently spend. Almost any family can live comfortably on less than they already spend. Now, by the way, if you find yourself needing help in this area, I recommend highly. I put it in a couple of recaps a couple of weeks ago when we were talking a little bit about finances. I recommend that you look at anything by Dave Ramsey. Total Money Makeover is a tremendous book by Dave Ramsey. Financial Peace, tremendous book by Dave Ramsey. He even has newer books than those. He does a great job of telling us how to get out of trouble financially. And it's a tremendous book. Well, Paul says this love, this leadership is supposed to be sacrificial. That is, the husband sacrifices for his wife and family. It sacrifices his own desires and puts theirs first. It's a nurturing love. He helps her to fulfill her potential. It's a caring love. He meets her material needs. And finally, it's an exclusive leadership, an exclusive love. That's what Paul says in verse 31. For this reason, and now he is quoting Genesis 2:24, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Now, I want you to understand something here. Whenever we talk about marriage in the New Testament, whenever the New Testament talks about roles, whether it's Peter, whether it's Paul, whenever the New Testament talks about marriage, talks about roles, it is always back to where? The beginning. God's design in the beginning, which is found in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. That's where he always goes. These people who accuse him of, well, he is promoting the culture of his day. As I shared with you last week, and I'll share with you more next week, Paul wasn't promoting the culture of his day. He was attacking the culture of his day, which made women nothing more than chattel, nothing more than something their husband owned. Paul said, that's not the way it is for a Christian man. But remember, whenever the New Testament talks about marriage, whether it's Jesus, Paul, Peter, it always goes back to Genesis. Always goes back to God's design at the beginning. That's why, that's where we started. Paul says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. This is an exclusive love. It is a committed love. It is the primary relationship now of his life. Well, that's the first responsibility, is to exercise loving servant leadership. Now, the second responsibility is found in Colossians chapter 3. So if you're in Ephesians 5, just start paging a few pages toward the back of your Bible. You'll come upon the book of Colossians. In between, you'll find Philippians. That's another great book, by the way, that Steve's been teaching here. You'll come upon Colossians. Look at Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. The second responsibility of a husband in marriage, of men in marriage, is found in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. It can be summarized this way: build up your wife, don't tear her down. Build up your wife, don't tear her down. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 19. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. The second responsibility of a man, biblical responsibility of a man in marriage, according to God, is to build up your wife. Don't tear her down with a surly attitude. Don't tear her down with sharp, unfeeling, and uncaring words. One writer said it this way: husbands are to exercise loving leadership, not dictatorial dominion. Perhaps husbands need this reminder to be tender and loving as much or more than wives need the reminder not to usurp authority over their husbands. Assuming absolute authority will only embitter one's wife, not endear her. Assuming absolute authority will only embitter one's wife, not endear her. It's interesting when Paul says, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. The word harsh in Greek is the word pikrino, pikrino. And interestingly enough, it is an onomatopoetic word. I practice saying that, onomatopoetic word. What does that mean? It's a word that sounds like what it is, okay? A word that sounds like what it is. I don't know if I've explained that the way a English teacher would do. My wife is an English teacher. But it's a word that sounds like what it is. Pikrino means don't pick at your wife. Don't pick at her. Don't be harsh with her. The word pick means, in Greek, the word pikrino in Greek means to become bitter or embittered. To become bitter or embittered. It's literally of something that's been swallowed that's bitter to the taste. It's the kind of bitter water James talked about in James chapter 3. You guys on Thursday morning with Steve have been studying that. It's a kind of bitterness. It's something that's bitter. Don't become that way with your wife. Figuratively, one writer said it means a surly, irritable attitude, sharp or piercing and harsh. Harsh and unfeeling, sharp and piercing. It's seen in men who are never satisfied, always critical of what their wives do. By the way, I hate to say it, but whenever I'm not literally with my finger pointing, but it is figuratively, right? Just remember the old saying, because this is really good, it's really true for me. Whenever I'm pointing at you, there are how many fingers pointing back at me? I'm paying attention to this in my life. My wife keeps me on the ball. Criticalness, never satisfied. Some men have a perfectionistic bent and they bring that to their marriage and to their wives, bringing tension home with you from work. Every marriage has multiple sources of irritations, multiple sources of irritations. Men, we are to be the ones who lead our families toward peace, who lead our families toward harmony. Sometimes we have unresolved expectations, sometimes unrealistic expectations, many times conflicting expectations with our spouse. Paul is saying that if you want the kind of marriage that God desires for you to have, you must love husbands, you must love your wives, and not pick at them. Not pick at them. The third responsibility of husbands in marriage is found in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Again, a few pages toward the back of your Bible, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. You'll come upon some of Paul's epistles, then you'll come upon the book of Hebrews, you'll come upon the book of James, and then you'll come upon 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3. In the beginning of that chapter, he speaks to wives who are married to non-Christian husbands, wives who are married to non-Christian, unbelieving husbands. And then in verse 7, he begins to talk to husbands. This is Peter now speaking to husbands. And Peter says this in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Paul is saying here that we are to be, as men, God expects us to treat our wives with consideration, with understanding, and with respect. Peter is saying here that God expects husbands in marriage to treat their wives with consideration, with understanding, and with respect. A husband, husbands in the same way, be considerate. The word considerate in Greek means according to knowledge or with understanding. In other words, it means that you are to know your wife. Men, you're to know your wife. You are to understand what makes her tick, so to speak. You're to know your wife's moods, her feelings, her needs, her fears, her hopes, her problems. Again, that takes time. Again, that takes energy on our parts. We can't put all our energy out there. It has to be exercised in our homes and in our marriages. We need to know our wife's moods, their feelings, their needs, their fears, their hopes, and their problems. We need to understand that they are different from us emotionally and physically, and the differences should be celebrated, not chafed at. Now, let me just spend 1 second, because our purpose isn't to exegete every one of these verses, or we'll be soon seeing God's Design for Marriage, part 72. You know, we want to bring this to a close at some point. What does it mean, the weaker partner? Now, literally nobody knows what that means. I can tell you some things that people believe it may mean. Some believe it may mean physically weaker. In most instances, we won't say every instance, but in most instances, men, because of the way God made men, some men have muscles, others, like me, you know, my six-pack has become a... at any rate, it's become a keg, okay? My six-pack has become a keg. But at any rate, men have more muscle. Men are usually stronger. And so there's a good chance that all he's talking about here are physical differences. Generally speaking, men are stronger than women. Women are weaker. Some people believe, and I think there may be some truth in this. Some people believe that weaker means her position is weaker in a sense. He is talking here in chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. He's talking about Abraham and Sarah. He's talking about how a woman responds even to a non-Christian husband. And some people believe that maybe he is saying that her position makes her vulnerable. Isn't that what happened to Abraham and Sarah? Her position made her vulnerable. So we don't know exactly what it means. It no doubt means something like physical. Some people say emotional. I say bunk. That's ridiculous. I would tend to think it's either talking about here physically weaker or her position. But nonetheless, let's focus on, you know, it drives me crazy when people spend all their time focusing, well, what could it mean? What does he mean by weaker? And they bypass the main teaching here, which is husbands, know your wives, respect your wives. That's it. Is that pretty tough to understand? It's not tough to understand at all. Let's focus there. That's where, respect your wife. That means the word in Greek is timē. It means to honor, to esteem, to value your wife. Treat her as someone special. A wife, Dr. James Dobson has said that a wife finds her greatest source of value in her marital and family relationship. Her self-esteem, she gets primarily from her husband and her kids. That's why it's so important. I think that's why God points out, husbands, treat your wives with consideration. Treat them with understanding. Treat them with respect. That's the third responsibility that God gives to husbands in marriage. If you don't treat your husband with your wife with respect, your children won't treat her with respect. If you don't treat your wife with respect, she won't be able to stand the pressure that society brings upon her biblical role. We already talked about treating our wives with common courtesy, not criticizing them publicly, and don't ever, ever, ever honor another woman above your wife. Ever. Can I say that again? Ever honor another woman above your wife. Warren Wiersbe said this, and we'll close for today. Next week, we're going to get into wives' responsibilities. There are four in marriage. Warren Wiersbe said this, the husband must be the thermostat in the home, setting the emotional and spiritual temperature. The wife often is the thermometer, letting him know what the temperature is. Both are necessary. The husband who is sensitive to his wife's feelings will not only make her happy, but will also grow himself and help his children live in a home that honors God. Isn't that what we want? Let's bow in prayer. Father, thank you. Thank you for laying it out for us, Father. Oh, Father, how we shrink your word to our puny ideas about what headship and submission mean. How we ignore the plain teaching of your word. Father, help the husbands of DRBC, including myself, to be loving servant leaders, to be those who treat our wives with respect and esteem, and not harshly, to be those who are understanding and respectful of our wives. Build our marriages so that we can be an example to the world around us. I pray in Jesus' name, amen.